Looking to take your business to the next level? Don't let staffing issues or HR red tape stop you from growing. The most successful businesses are those that have mastered their HR and staffing needs, and they have done it with O2 Employment Services. Finding qualified help is harder and more expensive than ever. HR regulations are getting more and more complex and confusing. For over 20 years, O2 has been providing the foundation successful businesses need to grow, assisting employers with their HR, payroll, workers' comp, benefits, and staffing. Partnering with O2 gives you the expertise you need to manage your business and employees. Outsourcing your HR and staffing is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity for successful businesses, and it is more affordable than you think. Let O2 show you how we can help you reduce your HR complexities, hire the right talent, and get back to growing your business. Call O2 today at 530-223-4674 or visit us online at o2es.com.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website, havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So, what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world: family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Arturo Fuente Chateau Maduro, handmade in the Dominican Republic with a dark Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, giving us a rich, medium-bodied cigar with pleasant notes of coffee, vanilla, and sweet spiciness. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends, the Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771. Or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons. Premium offerings. Unbeatable value. Just for you.
of the West. You spend some time in Chapter 5 talking about the case for Jewish nationalism, the legitimacy of the modern state of Israel. But you ask and answer a question, which is interesting. How would the American founders have reacted to the creation of Israel? Would they have understood and been supportive of it?
I think they would have been robustly supportive. In fact, the American founders in general were deeply, deeply, for the most part, philo-Semitic. Not exclusively. There are some potentially troublesome quotes from Thomas Jefferson if you really want to get into the weeds, although I note that even Jefferson himself wanted the great seal of the national states, or the national seal of the United States, to be Moses leading the Israelites across the Red Sea. He and Benjamin Franklin actually both wanted that to be the seal. But there are so many examples of the American founders just speaking of the Jewish people in just truly beautiful language. So just to give a couple of examples, one of my favorite lines here is from this 1809 letter that John Adams wrote to François Adrien van der Kemp. And in this letter, John Adams says, quote, "I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of the other sects who believe or pretend to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality and consequently of all civilization." It's a remarkable quote, really. I mean, talking about the Jews as the most essential instrument for civilizing nations, there's a very similar line that Alexander Hamilton had, where he essentially says that the state and progress of the Jews from their earliest history to the present time has been so extraordinary, so entirely out of the ordinary course of human affairs, that one must conclude that it is the effect of some great providential plan. So, to answer your question, Scott, I think that they would have been extremely favorably disposed towards contemporary Zionism, towards the notion of a free, independent, thriving, and flourishing state of Israel in the Jews' ancestral homeland.
Josh Hammer with us. Israel and Civilization is his new book. Let's talk a bit about the present. You say you get a question perhaps more than any other question on the topic, which is, what does America gain from our close relationship with Israel? How do you answer that question?
Well, there are a lot of ways that the United States gains from its relationship with Israel, for sure. There are any number of ways there. And look, I mean, we go in together, and the U.S. and Israel, we invest in defense technology. There's all sorts of concrete ways that the U.S. benefits when it comes to Iron Dome and missile defense collaboration, things like that. But I think the most obvious way that the United States benefits from its reliance with Israel is the mere fact that Israel is the United States, and by extension the West, man on the spot, essentially the entity there that is doing the West dirty work for it. So I talk about this a lot in chapter 6 of the book, probably above all. Let me just kind of paint that with a very concrete example. So I mentioned earlier how, you know, the success of the IDF since October 7, 2023 has not been just in the theater in Gaza against Hamas. It also has included Hezbollah in Lebanon, certainly against the Houthis in Yemen and so forth there. So just sticking with the Lebanon component there just for a second. So the grand prize for Hezbollah, Israel took out last September, Hassan Nasrallah. He was the, oh gosh, he was leading Hezbollah since around the time I was born, probably the early 1990s, give or take. So he was there for a long time. But before they got Hassan Nasrallah, the Israelis also took out two very high ranking Hezbollah top commanders by the name of Ibrahim Akil and Fuad Shakur. They are, in fact, the Hezbollah masterminds of, respectively, the 1983 U.S. Embassy bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, and the 1983 Marine barracks bombing. They slaughtered 241 Marines. In fact, the U.S. State Department had $7 and $5 million bounties, respectively, on those two Hezbollah jihadists' head for decades. Decades, and nothing happened until Israel just took them out essentially of their own accord. So, you know, the key purpose, or the key point as well, for people who champion a MAGA America First style foreign policy, which I myself am a champion of as well. I am a hardcore foreign policy realist. I have a whole chapter on this in the book, actually.
Yes.
But the key point is that this will actually, in theory, when you embolden your allies who have like-minded interests to you in the region, what it ought to enable you to do is then to strategically then pull back some of your forces, some of your bases there. You know, for instance, Tower 22, this U.S. military base in a far-flung corner of the country of Jordan that was that tragically saw three U.S. soldiers killed by an Iran-sponsored Iraqi militia in January 2024. You know, why in the world does the United States have a base there? I have no idea. I mean, in my estimation, the U.S. should probably be retrenching, if not fully closing, some bases like this. But the trade-off for that is that you have to embolden your allies to secure and patrol the region on your behalf. And for all the great work that Donald Trump has done when it comes to outreach to the moderate non-Islamist Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and so forth, there really ultimately is one country that is considerably more dependable and reliable than any other in the region when it comes to sharing American interests, and that obviously is the state of Israel.
We will return in a moment. Josh Hammer is with us. His book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to What's in a Name. Though this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story, it's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which, in turn, comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. Though the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago, the land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
You're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. As of October 1st, 1942, according to Kentucky Law Code, anyone who handles a reptile in a religious service can be fined anywhere between $50 and $100. Even with this deterrent in place, snake handling during Pentecostal church services remains as a practice in Kentucky's countrysides. Rattlesnakes tend to be the snake of choice, and as one would imagine, the practice can be dangerous, with multiple deaths having been reported due to these services. Additionally, members of these churches often refuse medical treatment in the instance of a bite for religious reasons. Kentucky is not alone in having these snake-handling churches. The first recording of this practice was in Tennessee, and spread throughout Appalachia and beyond, even reaching Los Angeles, California. Snake-handling churches derive from multiple verses in the Bible, including a literal reading from a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says, "They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Coming out of the Pentecostal movement, which is a form of evangelical Protestantism, participants wish to feel a close connection to God. Members of these churches have claimed that those who have gotten bitten have handled the snake before it was spiritually ready. Services can also include speaking in tongues and other characteristics of Pentecostal churches. This particular law is rarely truly enforced, so much so that there have been several attempts at shows and documentaries following these churches. Reptiles and snakes are legal to own, and police have said in the past that they will not charge anyone unless a child becomes involved. So, next time you're in Kentucky, be wary of rattlesnakes, lest you have a spiritual experience and find yourself having to pay for it. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're talking with Josh Hammer, Senior Editor-at-Large of Newsweek. He also hosts The Josh Hammer Show. His recent book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. Josh, chapter on realist foreign policy, a couple questions from in there. You spent some time talking about the neoconservative foreign policy, particularly in the wake of the September 11th attacks. But describe why and how, perhaps, our relationship with Israel, we should consider it outside the framework of a neoconservative worldview. How does that make sense?
When you think about what the apex, the pinnacle of neoconservatism, foreign policy, of that in the United States is, of a neoconservative foreign policy, you really would have to think about the Bush administration, right? I mean, that was kind of the quintessence there, the Iraq war, people like Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, and so forth there. And, you know, one thing that I remind the reader in this book is that if you actually look at the Bush administration's approach to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and so forth there, they were not necessarily the most hardcore all-in. Now, was President Bush anti-Israel? No, I certainly would not say that. He himself was an evangelical Christian, and he certainly had a certain kind of affinity for the Jewish state. But if you look well into 2008 and President Bush's final year in office, they were utterly obsessed. Condoleezza Rice, all the various tentacles of U.S. foreign policy at the time were obsessed with trying to get Israel to give land for peace to Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority, trying to carve out this new terror state in the heart of the Levant there between the river and the sea, as the case may be. And in the book, I argue that this is actually logical from the starting place of moralistic nation-building neoconservatism. When you accept the idea that idiosyncratic Western liberal ideals, kind of Jeffersonian, Lockean ideals, natural right to life, liberty, property, and so forth, when you argue, as President Bush did in his second inaugural address, his so-called freedom agenda, when you argue that these are not necessarily contextual civilizational principles, but truly universal principles, and then you also argue that they ought to be then exported by force if necessary, then it makes sense that the Palestinian Authority, the boondoggle in Ramallah, ends up being the grandest nation-building project of them all, actually. On the contrast, when that is not your starting place, when universalist values is not your starting principal position, but you are starting from a principal position, as President Trump does, and as he very clearly said in his speech in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia earlier, when you start there from the starting place of singularly pursuing the American national interest and doing that which redounds to the American national interest, no matter what that entails there, then you're going to see that an emboldened Israel serves the national interest. And there is no American national interest in carving out a new PLO terror state smack in the middle of the Levant in the Middle East. There's no benefit in this whatsoever, frankly, there. So when you start there, you're going to be naturally more inclined towards taking all sorts of measures, as, again, for instance, President Trump has done time and time again, to strengthen and embolden the U.S.-Israel alliance there. And frankly, it is not just a better starting place for U.S. foreign policy, which it is. Again, I've been a realist nationalist in foreign policy for essentially my entire adult life. But it's also a far better and more effective paradigm for viewing U.S.-Israel relations as well.
Josh, inside Israel and Civilization, you say that the U.S. annual aid package to Israel is unwise and myopic, and the cause of Zionism is undermined by the annual, not emergency, but annual large-scale military aid to Israel. So I just want to be sure, you're recommending ending essentially this annual military support package from the U.S. to Israel?
I am. I'm not arguing that this should happen overnight. I think it would be a mistake to pull the spigot, to pull the plug on this overnight, especially while you have an ally that is in the middle of a grueling, a horrific war. I mean, that is not the right message to send, not merely to Israel, but to all American allies there. So America absolutely should honor its current commitments when it comes to the large scale aid. But I think it would be in both countries' interest to establish a mid to long term game plan for winding down this aid. The aid ends up being something of a mutual bear hug, where I think both countries kind of feel that they are bound to this. I'm not entirely sure that it ultimately serves the best interests of, frankly, either side. So let me elaborate on that just for a second there. Israel does get a lot of aid. Again, a lot of aid relative to foreign aid. It's worth reminding that foreign aid in general takes up, frankly, a minuscule, truly minuscule proportion of the federal budget there. So a lot of propagandists make this out to be more important, frankly, than it is. But they are one of the largest recipients of U.S. foreign aid. But from an American perspective, that foreign aid to Israel, it's not a blank check to Israel. Israel ends up having to spend the vast majority of that aid money back in the United States. So it essentially ends up being really something of an implicit subsidy for defense contractors, for companies like Boeing, Northrop Grumman. And frankly, sometimes it actually ends up just being anti-Israel Democrats, people like President Barack Obama, who was the president in 2016 when the last decennial memorandum of understanding was signed there. And the reason I think a lot of these Democrats, whether it's Barack Obama, Joe Biden, or otherwise, actually like this large-scale aid to Israel is because it gives them more control. Mm-hmm. It allows them to essentially threaten to withhold aid,
right,
as Joe Biden did repeatedly in the year after October 7, 2023. It emboldens and empowers anti-Israel leftists to basically then try to coerce and control Israel in a way that they, frankly, would not do for any other ally. And that, in turn, then, from an Israeli perspective, has the unfortunate effect of undermining the entire purpose, the entire raison d'etre, the entire literally founding ethos of Zionism itself, which mm-hmm. is this notion that the Jewish people will control their own destiny in their own ancestral and biblical homeland. So I do think it is in the best interest of both countries to end this in the mid to long term, albeit that should not happen overnight.
I know we just have a moment left. I want to finish with one question on the final chapter. The Jewish-Christian Alliance to Save the West. You say we're at a crossroads right now. Why is now the time for that Jewish-Christian Alliance and Israel and Civilization, the name of the book, to sort of come together?
Well, I think that you can look around, Scott, and you can see that there are a lot of forces arrayed at this moment against biblical values, against the biblical inheritance, against the original people of both the Jewish people and the great Gentile offshoots, Christians, who have done more than anything else to build Western civilization over the past two millennia or so. You have people that are attacking Western civilization from the perspective of wokeism, from the perspective of Islamism, and the perspective of global neoliberalism. In the book, that's why I argue are the three hegemonic forces threatening to subjugate and, God forbid, destroy all of Western civilization there. So it makes sense at this time for the two inheritors and defenders of the biblical order to unite. And to be sure, there are some propagandists that are trying to tear us apart. There are a lot of people that on both sides, on both the Jewish left and then in Christian quarters as well, at least some of them on the fringes, that are trying to tear apart Christians from Jews and Jews from Christians. And it just makes so much sense to me, Scott, and October 7th is emblematic of this, but it's not the end-all be-all of the story. But at a time when the Bible, the values, the teachings, the morality, the lesson, the law, all of it, when all of it is under assault like nothing before from the wokes, the Islamists, and the global neoliberals, the two biblical religions just have to come together there. And, you know, for a very long time in U.S. politics, it seemed like that was going really well. I think that there are some people in both the left and certain pockets of the right that would like to end that alliance. But it seems to me that there is no better time than right now to double down and to make that Jewish-Christian alliance great again.
Josh Hammer, senior editor at large, Newsweek, host of the Josh Hammer Show, and author of the new book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, Mickey Maddox is with us, Flack Family Foundation Chair and Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale College. We talk about St. Augustine. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to KCNR 96.5 FM at 1460 AM, your talk radio. Online at KCNR1460.com.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, Your Talk Radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue, open and free, every other Sunday, right here on KCNR, Your Talk Radio.
Invest in your future today with a degree or certificate from Shasta College. Get job ready fast with one of our high demand career technical programs like nursing, heavy equipment, and welding. Or work on transferring to a CSU or UC with guarantee placement. Full-time students get 2 years tuition free. Summer session begins June 9th. Click or call 242-7650. Your success starts at Shasta College.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com. KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour, starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
Ready to turn your dreams into reality? At Simpson University, we offer a private Christian education that enriches your academic journey with faith and purpose. Whether you're pursuing your undergraduate degree, completing your degree, or advancing through graduate studies, our dynamic programs, personalized mentorship, and vibrant community are here to support you. Discover how Simpson University can help you achieve your goals and grow spiritually. Visit simpsonu.edu today to learn more. Simpson University, where your potential is limitless.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at School of Hard Knocks. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us.
This show's for educated voters, not for people that voted for Kamala Harris.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1468.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
A cancer diagnosis changes everything. But at Valor Oncology, located right here in Reading, you'll never face it alone. At some places, you see a rotating door of doctors, unfamiliar faces who don't know your history. But at Valor, you'll see the same expert team, a team that knows you, your treatment plan, and your journey. We have a Harvard-trained oncologist, a highly skilled female breast surgeon, compassionate and experienced nurses and nurse practitioners, and an incredibly dedicated staff that genuinely cares for you and your family. Our cutting-edge technology rivals top universities, but it's right here in Reading. You deserve the best care and a team that stays by your side. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation. Valor Oncology, rooted in Reading. Focused on you. Call 530-900-4000 or visit valor.org to schedule a consultation.
Milan, and if there were no St. Augustine, we would be talking about the guy who was in Milan, St. Ambrose of Milan. St. Ambrose was of the patrician class in ancient Rome, which meant that his family had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fantastically good human being. He brought with him a knowledge not only of the Greek language, but he was fluent as, or sorry, Latin language, but he was fluent as well in Greek. And so he'd read a lot of Greek theology. Augustine had problems with the Christian Bible. It seemed very unphilosophical to him. The first few chapters seemed about sort of fantastic things that one really couldn't believe. And so he kind of kept it at arm's length. And it was Ambrose who taught him to take these scriptures in perhaps more as a story of the journey of the soul than a story of, say, how the earth or when the earth was created or what happened between two brothers. And so at the end, Augustine was baptized in Milan. Then after a short time still living in Italy, he relocated back down to Africa and wound up actually in Tagaste, in this tiny little town he was from. And he was incautious enough, let's say, to show up at Mass one day when the church was in need of a priest. And those were the days when you didn't go to seminary or something. They just said, hey, you. And so Augustine became a priest and then later became a bishop in an important port city named Hippo, Hippo Regius. And so Augustine there served as bishop for about 40 years. As bishop, and in the time even before, his writings are voluminous. He was involved in every possible controversy, question. He was a deeply sensitive soul. People call him the doctor of grace, and surely that's true, but you could also call him the doctor of the heart, set free, you know, as it were, set free for God. So Augustine died at last in 430 when the Vandals were literally besieging his town, and it seemed that he lived in that sense at the end of the world. Yeah.
Let's answer this question at least briefly before we get into the theology, which is a lot of priests, a lot of bishops, right? So why, hundreds of years later, are we still talking about Augustine and not someone else from that time or from his town? What made him unique?
Augustine is singular. I would say that Augustine is the single most influential theologian in church history after Jesus and Paul. How's that? I'll be just straightforward about it.
That's a good wrap up.
Now, what I mean is not that Augustine is maybe the best. Lots of people might think he is. Some people might not. But he's the most influential. Augustine addresses issues that are current in his day in ways that just become canonical. Here's an example. In the so-called Dark Ages in the Latin West, sort of centralized systems have broken down and learning is at a kind of low ebb. There's a monastic library in a French town called Bec. It's quite famous because they have over 500 books. More than half of them are writings of St. Augustine. So, and of course, people also remember Augustine, and lots of people will have read his Confessions. Mm-hmm. The Confessions is like a brand new thing. Like, what are you doing here? You're exposing yourself in public. You're telling people who you are, how it feels inside of you, what your journey has been, what your sins have been. But of course, the book itself is cast in the form of a prayer to God, and the dialogue, the back and forth, is one that's meant to be not only a confession of himself before God, but then a receiving back from God his true self, insight into himself. So dialogue and not just monologue. Augustine is listening even as he's writing. Mm.
Talking with Dr. Mickey Maddox, who's Flack Family Foundation Chair and Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale, about the theology of St. Augustine. So let's start here. Mm-hmm. Augustine's concept of original sin. How does that help shape his understanding of human nature and morality?
Mm-hmm. So Augustine becomes convinced, both through his own experience and that story told back to God where he interrogates his own past and wonders through how it was that a guy like him, as lost as he had been, somehow at age 32 came to faith. Augustine had a notion about the human will, and see if I can do this kind of quickly. Augustine thought finite intellectual creatures like ourselves have a finite will, and there's a kind of inherent instability in this finite will. What that means is that I may make a New Year's resolution, and I may really mean it, but I may find that by March, probably sooner, I haven't quite lived up to it because my will has been a little bit weak. What is this weakness of the will? And so for Augustine, he can look back on his own experience and a kind of sudden conversion, or at least a kind of sudden decision for conversion. And for him, this is a moment where God intervenes effectively in his life. And the Spirit then, the Holy Spirit, will become the stabilizing force that helps that finite and unstable human will stick to the path. And so Augustine becomes very interested in grace, mm-hmm. how God is, without even being asked, is providing, is leading, is effecting, is enabling. And he wants to understand this process all through the Christian life, not just say at the point of beginning, but all the way through, all the way to final first perseverance in the faith.
We will continue in a moment with Mickey Maddox, professor of theology here at Hillsdale College, talking about St. Augustine. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Sample great food and beverages from local restaurants, wineries, and breweries while listening to The Billies, Anna Jay, Soul Punch, Ashley Black, and the Liquid Amber Band. Enjoy fun with the family with Redding Balloons and Face Painting by Squishy Doodle. There will be fun for the entire family, so come down to the 18th annual Taste of Redding, Sunday, June 8th at the Sculpture Park at Redding City Hall. Find the complete list of events and purchase your tickets by visiting us online at tasteofredding.org.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Alan Gordon, Coach Master Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs, and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website, havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Mickey Maddox, Flack Family Foundation Chair and Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale College, about the theology of St. Augustine. Dr. Maddox.
You mentioned grace. That's something I definitely want to ask about. His understanding of grace and how it relates to his views of salvation and perhaps the difference between other later theologians like Martin Luther, who you, mm-hmm. you studied quite a bit, mm-hmm. Thomas Aquinas, how does that compare?
So I think Augustine's influence in the case of both Aquinas and Martin Luther is massive. Each of them are very much Augustinian theologians. I would say that Aquinas follows a kind of trajectory in Augustine's thought that leads in the direction of what people call single predestination. That is to say that God indeed elects those who will be saved, but passes over those who will not be saved. That is to say, allows them, as it were, to damn themselves. This is usually distinguished from a kind of double predestination, where God chooses on both sides, mm-hmm. both who will be saved and who will be damned, which makes God sound a little arbitrary or something. Luther is often thought of as a guy who follows that second trajectory in Augustine's thought. I don't think that's correct. I don't think Luther has a proper double predestinarianism, and I think sometimes Luther is a man known to a little bit of hyperbole, and so sometimes in the hyperbole he goes a little bit overboard. He does so in the name of God's grace and with the intention to give God glory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of understandable, if you will, sort of rhetorical overreach. But in his quieter moments, Luther does not hold to a doctrine of double predestination.
Talking with Dr. Mickey Maddox about the theology of St. Augustine, Augustine's views, the nature of God, how do they influence his understanding of divine attributes like omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Augustine, prior to his conversion, he'd gone through that long phase where he was a Manichee. He thought this gave a kind of answer to the problem of evil. In the end, he decided that it did not. In fact, it just kind of leaves the problem of evil lying there as a thing that really is part of the very substance of things, right? So he's unhappy. He's disillusioned with Manichaeism for a long time before he leaves. But in the interval between that dissatisfaction and his conversion to Christianity, he is steeping himself in the writings of the Neoplatonist philosophers. And there are a couple of outstanding examples that Augustine knows from his own world of people who have read these texts and been attracted to Christianity. And, of course, the Neoplatonists have in mind the notion of God as the highest good,
mm-hmm.
as the transcendental, as the absolute that is beyond all conditioned life experience. And there's some sense in which they think we can rise up in our minds through abstract concepts, for example, into the sort of realm of the divine, permanent things that don't change. And Augustine finds there a kind of a real solution, a sort of, I think you could call it, I don't want to say a natural theology because it's not really driven by nature qua nature,
mm-hmm.
but a sort of intrinsic theology to the human creature. That is to say, a kind of inherent relatedness between the human being and God. And that, of course, is wonderful to know. A more difficult question is, well, how do I get right with this God? How do I tune my life to who and what God is? And for that, conversion is essential. So I would say that Augustine always retains these notions of God as the highest good, and so on, but everything ultimately is personalized
mm-hmm.
through the one God who is three persons, and most particularly through the Word of God who became human flesh. So Augustine is deeply Christological. But the philosophy helps, put it that way.
I want to circle back to this. Augustine and the concept of free will mm-hmm. and then divine predestination. How do those ideas and his views impact what he thinks about human responsibility and then, of course, salvation?
Right. So here's the trick. Free choice is no big deal. Everybody's got that. Augustine thinks that's true, too. Do you want Wheaties or Cheerios for breakfast? Choose. Pick one. The difficulty with choice is that our choices are conditioned always by something deeper in us. What is that? Love. What do I love? What do I want? And for Augustine, then, the problem with the sinful human being, and this goes back to your question about original sin, the problem is that we suffer from a kind of disordered love. And in this disordered love, there's a sense somehow in which the person is curved back in on herself, so that all the good she seeks, as it were, serve her as herself and establish herself or himself as the highest good, right? And so Augustine's question is, how do I get out of that crazy loop
mm-hmm.
of self-interest? And the answer for Augustine is that God really has to intervene. There has to be some kind of deep reordering. So that's what he senses in his own story. God, you were calling me to yourself before I even knew you were. And so it's a great, great story. And I would say here we sense the power of Augustine to speak to the present. If there's a universal human condition,
mm-hmm.
Augustine's got his finger on it.
How does he approach his interpretation of Scripture?
Hmm.
What methodologies does he use? How does he look at that?
Yeah. So Augustine is broadly an allegorical reader of the text, but what that means is that he wants to be sensitive to all the rhythms and harmonies and allusive qualities. And by that, I mean A-L-L-U-S-I-V-E, all the allusive qualities of the biblical text, the ways in which it leads our minds, leads us to think, and so on. Now, there's a problem with allegorical exegesis in, that is, interpretation of the Bible in Augustine's day. And the problem is it could be pretty arbitrary. If you just say, well, whatever the Bible says is however it makes me feel. Ouch. Who knows where that might go. So Augustine borrows from a fellow by the name of Tychonius in developing some rules for the interpretation of Scripture. And one of them that I think is really important is this. You cannot establish a doctrine of the faith without at least one explicit biblical text which says that according to the literal sense, not allegorically.
Mm-hmm.
So you can reflect on the text in terms of its figurative meaning, and that's productive. But when it comes to doctrine, you really need texts that are clear in the literal sense, not according to allegory. Yeah.
Let me ask one final question of mm-hmm. Dr. Mickey Maddox on the theology of St. Augustine. You told us earlier how influential Augustine was. Okay, how did he influence later Christian thought, Western Christianity, Protestant Reformation? He's in a lot of places.
Wow. I would say there have been eruptions all through the long history of the church of problematic receptions, let's say, of Augustine's teaching, particularly on grace.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest one occurred in what were called the semi-Augustinian controversies. And so there were folks who wanted to take Augustine's thought. There's a side of Augustine's thought that is double predestinarian, and they wanted to emphasize that. That was thought to be going too far. And so that was anathematized in the church, or something pretty close to it. In the Middle Ages, Augustine was so prominent. His writings were so voluminous. He wrote so much about Scripture. It's not just the treatises on the Trinity, which is like the treatise on the Trinity, but also the comments and sermons on the Psalms and on nearly all the Bible. So his impact continues. There are problematic receptions of Luther in modern Protestantism and Catholicism as well. In Protestantism, it's on the Reform side, and the Reform side has a controversy that leads ultimately to the Synod of Dort and the so-called Five Points of High Calvinism. Mm-hmm. And against that, you have kind of protest movements, so you have a kind of very strong Augustinianism over against a kind of modified, attenuated, maybe, reception of Augustine. On the other hand, on the Catholic side, we also have the so-called Jansenist controversy with Jansenius. And this Jansenist controversy, likewise, has to do with a reception of Augustine that the church deems just a little too strong. So one way you could say this would be the language of Joseph Ratzinger, the former Pope Benedict XVI. When you allow the sort of double predestinarian side to come out and be in the driver's seat, as it were, Ratzinger called that the triumph of system over faith. And I think that triumph of system is maybe something that's been associated with a kind of a problematic legacy of Augustine for a long time.
Yeah. Dr. Mickey Maddox is Flack Family Foundation Chair and Professor of Theology here at Hillsdale College. We talk about the theology of St. Augustine. Dr. Maddox, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Josh Hammer, his book Israel and Civilization, and Mickey Maddox, Theology Professor at Hillsdale College. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You can also find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Hello, my name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM, where I tell you all about the world's wackiest laws that are still on the books. Washington State is known for its lush forests, the city of Seattle, and, apparently, Bigfoot sightings. Skamania County in Washington has decided to take the supposed presence of Bigfoot seriously by passing an ordinance in 1984 that banned the hunting and killing of Bigfoot, with a punishment of an up to $1,000 fine and possible jail time. This is not the first ordinance to help protect the life of Bigfoot. An initial ordinance was passed in 1969 that made it illegal to hunt Sasquatch, with a much more severe punishment of an up to $10,000 fine and up to 5 years in jail. In 1984, the city council revisited the ordinance and decided to revise it. The decision followed an increase in activity in the area surrounding the search for Sasquatch. People were coming from all over to hunt the cryptid, causing some disturbance to locals. As a response, the county decided to make Skamania an official refuge for Bigfoot, especially since Bigfoot is classified as an endangered species. Don't worry, however, for all of you Bigfoot believers, it is still perfectly legal to go to the area to research and try and find the legend. Just keep it to pictures as proof. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Anne Jordan, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the Legislative Vesting Clause of the Constitution.
Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution states, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States." To the founders, legislative power was the power to make laws that apply to all alike, that are clear and easy to understand. The Constitution says all legislative powers, and that means Congress cannot rightfully delegate these powers to some other body. Today our laws are thousands of pages long. Sometimes rules are tens of thousands, and no one can read them. Congress has abdicated its legislative power to unelected bureaucrats and countless executive agencies. This is a violation of Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.